Recorded live from around British Columbia, Canada, this is Ramsey Theory. No strangers at this party. In this program, students of Ramsey Theory investigate the deepest questions in the field and dig into the lives of the most notable modern theorists. The podcast is hosted by Simon Fraser University, which is located on the unceded traditional territories of the Tsleil-Waututh, Coquitlam, Squamish, and Musqueam nations. This podcast was made possible by the students of Simon Fraser University's Ramsey Theory course, led by Dr. Veselin Yungich, who is also the producer of this series, as well as funding from the Mathcatcher Outreach Program. Stay tuned, because this is Ramsey Theory, no strangers at this party.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Ramsey Theory, No Strangers at This Party. My name is Wasim Khalifi, and I'll be hosting this podcast today with my partners, Connor Miriam and Manan Sood.
Hi there. My name is Wasim Khalifi. I'm an undergraduate student at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I'm majoring in computer science while also pursuing a minor in mathematics. I'm interested in mathematics because, to me, it resides on the edge between science and art. On one hand, there are concrete answers that leave little room for interpretation. But on the other hand, it sometimes takes great creativity to find a solution. Through this Ramsey Theory podcast, I hope to learn more about mathematics through the lens of seasoned mathematicians.
My name is Connor Merriam. I'm an undergraduate physics student at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia. I'm minoring in mathematics. I'm currently taking a class on Ramsey Theory, and I got into this project because I'm interested in becoming a science communicator and teacher. I think there's a lot of work to be done in simplifying interesting, complex ideas in ways that allow more people to understand them, develop interest, and make them more accessible to everyone. I hope this podcast accomplishes some of that idea.
My name is Manan Sood. I'm an undergraduate student at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I'm in my junior year majoring in business, along with completing a minor in mathematics. I've always been interested in mathematics because of its definite yet exploratory structure. Throughout this podcast, I aim to understand how great contemporary mathematicians think and go about solving complex problems.
And so through this podcast, we hope to learn more about Ramsey theory and notable Ramsey theorists. Today, we are very grateful to be speaking with notable American mathematician, Dr. Bryna Krah. Dr. Krah is a Sarah Rebecca Rowland Professor at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, working in ergodic theory and dynamical systems. Dr. Krah graduated with a bachelor's degree from Harvard University in 1988 and obtained her PhD from Stanford University in 1995. Welcome, Dr. Krah.
Hello, nice to be here.
So I guess just to start off the conversation, we should probably learn more about our guest. So if you will, would you mind sharing a little bit about yourself growing up?
So I grew up on Long Island near New York City, about an hour away. And it was a very mathematical household. My father is a mathematician. And so I was always surrounded by math, but I had a lot of other interests as well growing up, not just math.
That's really cool. And I guess what would you say first interested you in math to pursue a career in it?
Well, first, I didn't want to pursue a career in it. So I when I was an undergrad, I did take math as a freshman, and I did not take any math after that as a sophomore because I decided it was not for me. I then changed my mind later after talking to my professor from freshman year and went back to it. But that's a different story. By then, I realized that I was drawn to the beauty and the intricacies and the difficulty of it, because I really do find math is hard. But Definitely. That's one of the appealing things about it.
Yeah.
Can I ask, was there anything like specific that drove you away from it? Was it like the first time learning calculus, it's always hard? Or
so I had actually already done calculus and multivariate calculus in high school and linear algebra. So I had done all of those things. And you're right, I didn't find them very hard then, but eventually all math eventually gets really hard for everyone at some point. And it did for me. I found it just very competitive class, and I didn't really like that. So I d- decided it wasn't for me. It was competitive, abstract. I liked the abstract part, but I didn't really like the atmosphere, and it was a lot of work. So it was just too much at that point. But those were the exact same things that drew me back in later. So it worked both ways.
I guess the next question I have with like just the intro is like, so what would you say would be your first memory related to mathematics?
That's a good question. I was always surrounded by math. There was just math in our house at all times, whether it would be my dad sitting there grading papers or some game in the car that we would be playing that was, you know, well, I later learned that college students played them as drinking games, but for us, they were counting games, right? So the various games like that in the car, math was just always everywhere. I was on the math team when I was pretty young, took math competitions, which I didn't really like, but I did them. So I don't think I can have an earliest memory because I just don't remember not having math sort of surrounding me at all times.
You remember any like a specific example of a game?
Well, we used to play a version of BizBuzz with counting when any time it was visible by 3 or 7, you had to alternate between Biz and Buzz and you'd count up. Yeah. Ours were extra hard because you had to alternate and we'd do 3s and 7s and then anything that had a 3 in it. So all of 30, you'd count BizBuzz, 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 getting up till 40. And we had lots of variations of it. So there was the simple one that you would just start with 3s and then you do 3s and 7s. And then we would do, if it was divisible by both 3 and 7, then you said it out loud instead of not saying it, and, you know, many variations.
Yeah. It's interesting because I grew up playing a similar game back home. It was not as difficult as the 7 and 3s. We used to just stick to 5 and did not alternate. So yeah, even for me, the version you played seems like a more pro version of what you used to play.
Do you think playing those games when you were growing up gave you any kind of like fondness for math in general? Or was it just kind of a thing that was like around all the time?
I'm not sure if it was fondness or not, but it does give you a deep number sense when you play games like this and do lots of counting games. It gives you a deep understanding of how things fit together in a basic way in some sense. You know, we were all competitive and there were 5 of us and then a car trip. This was a great way to, you know, spend a lot of hours.
Definitely.
And then you said that you were like on math teams. Would this be in like high school or elementary school?
So by high school, I did not do math teams, even though I was in all the advanced math classes and taking math at the college. I didn't like them. I just didn't like them. So I chose not to do them. I was doing many other activities. And so one more was just not necessary.
That's fair. So I guess the main topic of our podcast is, of course, Ramsey theory.
So that's funny. So I don't consider myself a Ramsey theorist. My work touches on it, but I don't know that I've ever, well, maybe it depends what you define it as, but I did learn about Ramsey theory in high school. So I have to admit this. I knew Joel Spencer through my dad, and he is a Ramsey theorist. And I had a book of his that I looked at and I had started reading in high school. It's a graduate textbook, but I was just reading the beginning. I found it fascinating. And so because I knew him, I'd read in that book about certain theorems, basic Ramsey theorems, like the question about how many people do you need to, so that if you take a group of that number of people, there are 3 who've all shaken hands or 3 who've never shaken hands. So this is what's known as the Ramsey number of 3-3.
Yeah.
And at some point, it might have even been in middle school, I did a math project on this and, you know, wrote down the proof of why the Ramsey number for 3-3 was 6 and worked out using graphs and pictures of it. But it's deep math, right? I mean, this is very deep. And okay, some of the easy ones, you can make arguments like this, but then you get into these arguments, which are so deep and can seem daunting if you don't approach it correctly, right? So if you start without the framework in the background, then it's of course impossible, but that's how all of learning is. Just math seems to have more, you really need to understand the previous level before you go up. Like building a building, you need the scaffolding. You can't just jump up and start building the top floor.
Strong foundation, right? Yep.
So in terms of Ramsey theory, and like as much as you know about it, what would you say is like the most interesting thing about Ramsey theory itself?
Well, it's as you sort of said a little bit before, you start with the most minimal information and you conclude incredibly strong things. So all of these theorems, they have the form of you take some set, you take some structure, you take some something, and inside, when you just do some very simple things, you have to have structures there, things that cannot be eliminated. You can do them as coloring, think of them that way, but they can also be density arguments, even more complicated, where you take sort of large, in some sense, sets or objects, and you find patterns in them. To me, this is one of the most beautiful aspects of mathematics, is when you find something that's really unexpected, that must be there.
If you could, how would you describe Ramsey theory to a five-year-old?
Well, if I were describing to a five-year-old, I would tell them, how about this? I would ask them if they know what it means to add two numbers. And many five-year-olds have a good idea of adding two numbers. And then I would tell them that we're going to play a game. You're going to be able to color the integers red, and I'm going to color them one by one blue. And you're going to try to make it so that I cannot put in my blues two numbers that add up to a third number and they're all blue. Or they put in their reds two numbers that add up to a third number in all red. And I said, I'm going to try to stop you and you're going to try to stop me, and we'll see how far we can go. This is Schur's theorem, which says that if you have color enough of the integers, you must have A and B and C such that A plus B equals C all in one color. But you can actually play this game with a kid, with a little kid, and they'll, you know, first of all, they'll figure out adding up a lot of numbers. It takes a lot of work because, but very quickly you'll convince them that they can't do it. They can't stop you from making one of these patterns.
At that point, do you try to convince them why, or do you think that's a little too advanced?
So I think that one's a little too advanced for kids, but you can do other ones. You can, for example, draw the numbers. Well, I like to do like 1 to 100. You don't need 1 to 100. You only need, I think, 1 to 27 maybe in a grid. So that you have 10 numbers, so it's a 10 by 10 grid, and you just label them. And then you could say, okay, let's two color this and find somewhere in there a rectangle that all four corners are the same color. This is very geometric, and you can make a completely elementary proof of this using the pigeonhole principle. So you can prove very simple things like arguing if you have three objects, then two of them are the same color. Well, that's a basic Ramsey theorem. If you take three objects and you color them red or blue, two of them are the same color. That's the pigeonhole principle. And that's the only tool that's needed to prove that you have a rectangle inside that grid, the way I explained to draw it, that all four corners are the same color.
So I guess we could talk a bit more about your work. And so I had a question here. So in 2010, you're awarded the Levi L. Conant Prize for the Green Tau Theorem on Arithmetic Progressions in the Primes, an Ergodic Point of View. So I guess to start, can you like explain in simple terms the problem you were exploring?
Yeah, so this was actually a paper that I wrote about a very famous result of Ben Green and Terence Tao. And so this was a result that sort of took the math world by storm. It was really somewhat surprising because there had been no progress on it for a very long time. And what their result says is if you take the primes, so you know what the primes are, numbers that can only be divisible by one in themselves. So 2, 3, 5, 7, not 9, and keep counting, then if you take the primes and you look at them, then inside the primes, there are arbitrarily long, so however long you want, maybe length 10, maybe length 20, arithmetic progressions. And what's an arithmetic progression? It means you start somewhere at some number, let's call it A, and you add a fixed amount. So you look at A plus B, and then you keep adding B, so A plus 2B, A plus 3B. And what their theorem says that somewhere in the primes, there's a pattern like that. So now if you're looking at the primes and you wanted to find an arithmetic progression of length 3, this is not hard, right? Because you would just look at 3, 5, 7, because you just add 2 to 3 and you get 5 and add 2 to 5 and you get 7. But if you tried to find an arithmetic progression of length 4, you'll be able to find it pretty easily. It won't have gaps. It won't be as simple as 3, 5, 7, because 9 is not a prime, right? So you'd have to look further out. You can find, well, I won't try to come up with one on the fly, but you can find one of length 4. Probably the gaps will be bigger than the 2 gap that we use, the jump of 2. And you can keep looking, but what their theorem says is that however long you want it, somewhere out there, there'll be these patterns. So it's a Ramsey type theorem, taking some big set. There's here the big set is primes, which are actually not so big, but finding some pattern in them. And it turned out that the method they used was very similar to something that had been done in my field, which is ergodic theory, that had been done by somebody named Hillel Furstenberg, who had proven a very famous Ramsey theorem. It's called Samarides theorem, using ergodic theory. So it's a very different point of view. It doesn't have these types of counting arguments where you can sort of use the pigeonhole principle easily and things like that. It's a very different one. And so what I wrote is an explanation of the point of view on their article from the point of view of ergodic theory.
Explain a little bit about what ergodic theory is.
Sure. So it's more abstract than combinatorics, but it does, which is the counting of things, but it does get used in combinatorics. It's a way I study very abstract versions of systems, and I'll explain what a system is. So a system is you take some space, maybe that space is all the particles in a bucket of water, or maybe that space is the planets rotating around the sun. Or maybe that space is just some abstract version of that. And I study those abstract versions. And you have some rule where you do the same thing over and over. So for the planets moving around the sun, this is a very nice one. You have the planets, they rotate around. The rule doesn't really change. We can basically assume that, you know, eventually it'll change, but not in our lifetimes. And you keep doing this over and over, the same rule. And what ergodic theory wants to do is make long-term predictions about what will happen. So you're trying to find sort of behavior that is there, but that you might not know from the short-term behavior of just this rule that tells you what happens in the next second and what happens in the next 10 seconds. So you keep repeating the same rule over and over and then try to make predictions.
Is it somehow related to chaos and randomness? Does it branch out in those fields, those concepts as well?
Exactly, it does, because all of these things, especially if we're looking for patterns, the opposite of patterns would be chaos. And so you want to understand the difference. And this is made very precise in ergodic theory by certain notions of what is a pattern and what is the version of chaos, where things all mix up and you don't see patterns. So it's a back and forth between the two fields that goes way back, goes back to the 70s.
Wow, cool. Would you say that this is your first eureka moment, or do you have another story about that?
Well, so my first eureka moment was a very little theorem that was proven while sitting in a beautiful mountains in southern Spain, looking at the mountains, and suddenly I understood something I'd been working on. It was a small result, but it was something that it was definitely my first time of really seeing how something worked. This was much more of a gradual understanding rather than a eureka moment. Most of math is more of a gradual understanding where you begin to put things together and begin to see how they are.
Definitely. I feel like I got to ask now, what was that theorem that you discovered?
Oh, it was just a very little theorem of understanding something about certain patterns inside sets to see how they had to keep happening, recurring. It was about something called recurrence and seeing how certain patterns had to keep coming back.
Was there anything about the mountains or the area you were in that like really got you thinking about it? Or was it just kind of the mindfulness of really sitting there and thinking?
Well, so I had been working on it for quite some time. It wasn't sort of, and that's how all of math is. You sit there, you work on it, and then, yeah, at some point you suddenly get it, but it's not because of the work you did right then. Mm-hmm. Sort of the work you did maybe for weeks, months, sometimes years before that. I was sitting there because I had injured my leg and couldn't go hiking. So I just was taking in the beauty and looking at it and doing math. Nothing. There are a few people out there, I think, who do have those eureka moments over and over, but they also have been working really hard.
It's a lot like climbing a mountain in some ways, right?
You work so hard until you like get to the top and you see the beautiful view.
And then you see somebody way over there and they have a different mountain and you're like, how'd you climb that?
So I guess touching a bit on that with like math in general, where do you see the beauty or elegance in mathematics?
Well, there's many different ways, but I think for me, one of the things that's really beautiful is when you see connections between different areas, especially if you take two seemingly unrelated areas and suddenly you see that there's this deep connection between them. So that's exactly why this ergodic theory viewpoint on the theorem of Green and Tao about the primes was so nice, because you see how ergodic theory viewpoint is, it seems like it's a very different field, but it turns out it's not.
Do you think math was discovered or invented?
I don't really think of it as either. I do think we sort of, it's in between. So I guess I'm not going to really weigh in on whether it's discovered or invented. I do think that there are fundamental things that we uncover, but I'm not quite sure that that's really discovery in the same way. Well, we certainly invent sort of names and terminology and ways of talking about it. So it's got to really be part of both. But these are, one of the things about math is it's basically uncovering fundamental truths. So
a majority of students, at least that I know, they're kind of like hesitant when they talk about math and they find it very difficult. So I guess what would you say to people who find math opaque or difficult?
You know, I often think that when it's opaque, it's because people are missing the background, missing the foundations and the scaffolding that they need. And sometimes it just hasn't been taught in the right way for that person. I do think that basically everybody can learn, certainly all the math through undergraduate level. I don't think there's any obstruction to that, except for poor background and maybe poor teaching beforehand. And that can take a lot to overcome.
What do you think, like, you could get anybody interested in math?
Well, that's a tall order. Anybody? No, but I do think I could convince most people to think about some things in math. And I think I've tried on various little kids sometimes. They'll come up and ask me what I do, and I will sort of not really tell them what I really do because that's too hard, but I will tell them something related.
Do you ever find that the kids are a lot more receptive than the adults, or?
Oh yeah, the kids are much more receptive than the adults, but many adults unfortunately have been turned off to math, right? This is one of the problems. And so then you have to undo that first before you get into the doing.
I was just curious, like, how do you, because when I talk to my friends who are not into mathematics about ideas in mathematics, the first question that they come up with is like, where do you actually use it in your life?
So the kind of research I do, I will admit that today does not have any applications. I don't see any applications for it right now, and I'm not sure I see any in the next 10 years. Yet, this kind of research is fundamentally important because we don't know what research will be useful. When the number theory that was developed, that's used to do all the transactions online that your credit cards do, all of that encryption and all of that number theory is over 50 years old, much of it. There's we could not wait to develop the math until it's needed because it takes too long to develop. Math gets developed, discovered, uncovered, invented, however you want to put it, at a very slow pace because we just get incremental new knowledge each time. So we do have to do the research now for the possible future applications.
So how would you say the field of mathematics changed over your life?
Well, it's deeper. There's more. The amount of math being produced is huge. Currently there's more research published than there was 10 years ago, and 10 years ago has more than 10 years before that. And even the rate of production of research is increasing. So there's just a lot to learn to get involved in math research at this point, much more than there used to be. So it's exactly what you say. Math is now everywhere. So it's very important. All of these things. So this has really changed, but it's also become much more collaborative. This idea that mathematicians sit in a corner and work on their own, coming up with a brilliant idea and then go and write the paper, it doesn't really happen that way anymore. Most people, people will write something on their own, but then most people work on most of their research in collaboration. It's become this very collaborative field in ways that have really changed since I started in it.
I'm curious, like, what your Erdős number is, like, because Paul Erdős is known for his collaboration. The number one guy around Ramsey theory who was open to all. I'm just curious, like.
So I guess my Erdős number is 2. Multiple pathways to. I have several collaborators who collaborated with Erdős.
Really, do you think math is like more accessible now, or do you think it's because there's so much more research? Do you think it's harder to get into because there's more to learn, or?
Oh, it's probably a little bit of both. It's more accessible because there are more ways to learn it. More online tools. There's lots of great videos online teaching people things about math. But if you're going to get into research, there's just more to learn. It takes longer.
Totally makes sense. Yeah.
An important thing we wanted to note or ask you was, how do you think it is different navigating the world of mathematics as a woman? So like, what are some challenges that aspiring female mathematicians unfortunately would have to face?
Yeah, so there are challenges, they are different. It is different being a woman. You often go to a conference and you're the only woman speaking, things like that. This is true, one is still, as a woman in math, I'm still a minority. It's distressing that it hasn't changed very much. But one of the things that I always give advice to people is that there are mentors out there of all types and sizes, and your mentor doesn't have to look like you. So my strongest mentors in my life have all been men. So they've really supported me and helped me to get to where I am and do the things I've done and encouraged me, because everybody needs encouragement all the time. Everybody needs encouragement. So it's tough. I think it is tough, and it is an issue, and one has to be confident and ready to deal with that. On the other hand, I don't really think it's maliciousness, just people don't realize that it how it feels to be the only woman in a room, but it's true for other historically underrepresented groups in math. And I have really worked hard to try to change these issues in mathematics, but this is a slow change, very slow.
Yeah, our professor, he mentioned something to us today that kind of stuck with me, that it seems like a lot of the time in these like predominantly male-dominated fields that the women have to be almost twice as better to compete a lot of the time. And so for him, he found that there's a lot of respect for female mathematicians because of that. Do you think there's a lot of truth to that?
There's some truth in that, I would say. It goes both ways. I think oftentimes women who do things are not taken as seriously until they've really reached a certain level of achievement. So it takes longer to get there. This is unfortunate because we should be judging things on the mathematics and the achievements, but often people will discount, and especially collaborations, people will often say, oh, well, she collaborated with him. With the implication being that he did the work. But, you know, collaborations are not really that way. It doesn't work that way.
That's why it's called collaboration. It's everyone.
You mentioned that you did a lot of competitions, and that I think at one point you also mentioned that you got your hands on that graduate textbook at some point in high school, right? Why didn't you like the competitions? And were you in them a lot because you were like a higher achieving student, or how did you get into those?
Well, so I didn't do them in high school. I did them before that because I was high achieving and did pretty well on them before that, before I stopped doing them. I didn't like them because I didn't really like the competitive nature. And at the time, I was really the only girl who was going to these things, and that wasn't appealing. I had lots of other activities I did that were mixed gender, and I preferred those activities.
Yeah. How do you think we can maybe make those things more appealing to that version of you?
Well, so I don't know that competition, math research is not about the, it doesn't work the way competitions work. So I don't know that I see the utility in making competitions more open to get more girls involved in them. Math research is a very different thing. It's a slow process. Competitions are about speed and individuality, whereas math research is often about working with other people and working slowly and sitting with something and waiting until it really begins to work in your head. So there are different skills. And I think often math excellence is equated with excellence at these competitions, but to me, they're really two separate things. Yeah, they're fun for people who like them. I mean, I have to say my kids like them. They do them. It's not something that I like.
Do you think there's like a different version of that sort of outreach that could be done then?
I think getting people interested in thinking about math, I liked that I could take this book in Ramsey theory and read. Okay, I couldn't get very far into it, I'll be honest, right? But I could read the beginning, I could read the introduction, I could see that there was beauty there. That is something that's really worthwhile.
You were talking about the moment, like after your first year, you decided not to pursue mathematics, right? Could you like expand just a little bit about that?
Sure.
Yeah.
So I had found that course really overwhelming and difficult. I can't say by the end, I worked really hard in the first semester. By the second semester, I really decided this was too much work and it wasn't for me. And I went to see the professor, I think it must have been after the final, just to see how I did. And he said, well, the class was very bifurcated and there were some scores at the top and some scores at the bottom. And he said, I have good news and bad news for you. The good news is you are at the top. The bad news is you are at the top of the bottom. And I said, yeah, it's okay. I'm really not planning to take any more math. I'm done. This is it. But thank you for the exam and thank you for the course. I thought the lectures were great and I enjoyed getting to know the professor who I'd gotten to know. And so then I went off and I was a philosophy major for the next year. I still did some math though, because I was a math TA, teaching assistant. So I still did some and had my finger thinking about math a little bit, or brain thinking about math a little bit, but I was not taking any courses. And then the beginning of my junior year, I had decided that I was done with philosophy. It was just not for me. And I went back to that same professor and I said, I really don't know what to do because I'm not interested in taking these philosophy courses that I thought I was going to take. None of them sound interesting. And the first lectures were all not for me. And he said, well, what do you miss? And I said, I miss the rigor, the beauty, the analysis and so on. And he said, you miss math, you mean? And I said, oh, whoa, yeah, that is what I miss. And then I took four math classes. So, you know, he was both the person who chased me out of math and brought me back into math without knowing either way that he was doing either one of those.
Do you think there's a reason that you quit math that you maybe shouldn't have, or?
I think I quit it because it was sort of scarily hard in some way. And then at a certain point, I decided it's okay to do something that's scarily hard. And in fact, that's appealing. What drew me in is that the math was the hardest thing I knew to do. So it seemed worthwhile doing the hardest thing.
Wow.
It's really interesting that you mentioned that you were a philosophy major as well, because I remember we learned about Ramsey and we learned about all these mathematicians, and even they, like, in addition to math, they also like learned about philosophy. Or do you guys remember who was it? Was it Rado that like he played the piano?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That was.
Yeah.
Also a different time, right? People were much more, people were much more broadly educated. I do think that there is a lot of virtue in that and doing other things at the same time. One can't do math all day. I can't do math all day. Very few people can. Some people can, but I can't.
So what kind of advice would you like to give to a young person thinking about going into a PhD program?
Yeah, so I would advise them, well, it depends. If they're convinced they want to go into math, then I would encourage them strongly. But if they're not convinced they want to go into it, I would ask them to really think about it heavily before starting a PhD, because it's a real commitment. It's going to be difficult. And I think one has to be honest with oneself that doing a PhD in math or any other subject is really hard. It's a lot of work and you have to be really committed to it. But if you're convinced that you love the math, then there's nothing better to do.
I guess a more general question now. If you could go back and speak to your younger self, what advice would you give?
Oh, I would tell my younger self to be a little bit more confident and not to worry so much and just to sit down and focus on the work rather than worrying about getting things done.
Could definitely relate to that.
I think we all
could. Yeah. So if you had more free time, what do you think you would spend it on?
Oh, that's a good question. If I had more free time, I think I might learn another foreign language. I think I like foreign languages. I would probably do more reading.
I think the language that you're such an expert on is like so universal.
I really enjoy learning foreign languages because I think it changes the way you think, just like math changes the way you think. So you think about everything mathematically, the same with foreign languages.
Is there like an unofficial capital for mathematics?
I think it's quite field dependent, but no, I don't think there's really a capital.
And I guess like in ergodic theory, where do you think it would be?
Ergodic theory, probably the strongest places historically are France and Israel. So.
Interesting. Is there anything you're working on currently that you think maybe the public should know about?
Well, I've been thinking, I don't know that the things I'm working on now would be particularly interesting to a general public, but I think about some very basic problems in an area called symbolic dynamics now, which is also related to Ramsey theory. Or once again, I'm looking for distinguishing structures. This has been a common theme that I really enjoy.
Well, thank you, Dr. Kreff, for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak with us on our Ramsey Theory podcast. We really appreciate your answers you shared with us today. And I'm sure that they'll be of great use to the general public.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And so thank you to everyone for listening to our podcast. We hope you learned a bit more about Dr. Kra, a prominent 21st century mathematician. We've been Wasim Khalifi, Connor Miriam, and Manan Sood, and this has been Ramsey Theory, No Strangers at This Party.
Broadcasting live from the traditional territories of the Tsleil-Waututh, Kukwetlam, Skahomish, and Musqueam nations, this has been Ramsey Theory, No Strangers at This Party. This podcast was made possible by the students of Simon Fraser University's Ramsey Theory course, led by Dr. Veselin Yungich, who is also the producer of this series, as well as funding from the Math Catcher Outreach Program. My name is Aidan Wright. I'm the editor of this project. I currently study at the University of Victoria. The soundtrack to this program is titled Rising Ronald in Memory of Ronald Graham. It was written by Nina Jokic, another alumnus of the Simon Fraser University Ramsey Theory course. Tune in again soon for more of the latest in Ramsey Theory, and to hear more from mathematicians working at the edge of human knowledge. Thank you for listening.